Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about doing things in parallel on processors. And to talk about that, we first needed to review how our processor worked when it didn't do things in parallel. And we had this one particular model of a processor we started with, which I believe is the kind of model for how you build a processor that you saw in CS01, which is that we have this processor that runs one instruction per cycle. And in that design, we have our PC register change at the what we'll call the beginning of a clock cycle, and that causes components to sort of cascade, making a whole bunch of changes, and eventually producing the results for that instruction, you know, triggering writes to registers and writes to memory as needed, and so on. And an observation we had about this design is that, well, there are some components in the processor that, well, actually most components, that seem like they're not really doing work most of the time. So for example, we had a bunch of things that are fed from this instruction cache access. And that instruction cache access, therefore, presumably happens sort of in the early part of that clock cycle, and then the instruction cache basically is not doing anything in this design. That seems awfully inefficient, because, well, shouldn't we have the instruction cache start fetching the next instruction earlier than that? But in this design, we say we're gonna wait for the whole next cycle. And the same was true for, say, our logic, which did math. That when, if we're doing an addition, we're going to do one addition. That's going to happen in a relatively small part of our clock cycle. And then that circuit's basically going to be idle the rest of the time. And we saw kind of an analogy with what we do in a more real-world situation with this kind of problem with laundry. That if I have a washer and a dryer, I don't just say, I'm done with the washer, I'm not going to use it anymore. We want to say the same thing about our instruction cache or our arithmetic circuit. And what we end up with is this assembly line solution where we're going to do the first step of the first instruction, and then we're going to do the second step of the first instruction, but rather than not starting the next instruction, we're going to do that. So we're going to do the second step of the first instruction while we do the first step of the second instruction. And then we're going to move on to the third step of the first instruction, but we're not going to have the other instructions not do anything at that time. Now that we freed up the step two circuitry, we're going to do step two of the second instruction and step one of the third instruction, and so on. So we have this kind of assembly line for running instructions. And this is going to let us sort of run a lot of instructions at once. And ultimately, if we're thinking of clock cycles, our clock cycle is going to be a lot shorter. And during each of them, instead of running a whole instruction, we're going to run part of one. So we wanted to think about, well, so where did the benefit come from for this? And that was, well, that we were trading off. We were increasing our throughput, but also increasing our latency. And remember, throughput was sort of how much work we got done per unit time, and latency is how long each of those units of work took. So it turned out that this new design runs instructions slower. And that's because, well, we had, at a minimum, to add some extra circuitry to handle passing values from one step to the next while letting the prior step work on something new. And that circuitry was adding registers. But even though the instructions take longer end to end, we're doing more at a time, so we end up with an overall improvement on throughput. And if we're thinking of running a program with billions of instructions, we care about that throughput number. We don't really care about the latency number. Okay, so questions? First half of it. So we started looking at sort of how pipelining worked out. So one thing we figured out is that in this design, our slowest stage determines our cycle time. So everything has to go as slow as the slowest step. We saw that in this kind of our laundry example where we had our dryer. You know, if our dryer is slow, that means that, you know, even if I can do, you know, two loads of laundry for every in the washer for every load of laundry the dryer handles, I'm not really going to be able to take advantage of that because I'm just going to be wasting time piling up loads of laundry and nothing will get finished earlier. So in our processor, we're going to set a single cycle time based on the slowest stage. We also found out that sort of as we add these stages in a circuit, we need something to hold the values between the stages, and these were registers, and registers aren't going to be free. So they're going to take some extra time. So as we add pipeline stages, we're going to add, have more, a larger portion of our time spent handling these register reads and writes for these intermediate pipeline registers, these ones between those stages. And we also learned that, well, as we try to add stages to our processor, often they won't be split up evenly. So in the design I showed, we had the instruction cache access was one stage, and the register read was another. And probably those don't take exactly the same amount of time. And that means we're wasting some time there because our cycle time is going to be set based on the slowest one. And therefore, we have some time we're not really using. And this phenomenon is going to become more and more extreme the more stages we try to divide our instruction into. Now, and we want to do that because, as we add more stages, hopefully we can keep decreasing the cycle time and therefore increasing our throughput. But we're going to get these diminishing returns, and eventually it's not going to be worth it. So that was for pipelining when everything worked out. And when we finished up last time, we were starting talking about this issue of data hazards, that I kind of assumed that by running the instructions step by step, that was fine as long as we, did the steps in order for each instruction and started the instructions in the right order. But it turned out that by doing these instructions in these steps, we ended up reordering the operations of the instructions relative to another. And a case where we saw this is that it could turn out we would read values before we would try to read a value before it was written. Because, now with our new design, some instructions write values in a later cycle, then the next instruction will read it. And this was not really acceptable because we don't want instructions to give us the wrong numbers, and we needed to do something about it. And our solutions that we started with weren't so great. They all were things which kind of got rid of our benefit of pipelining. So one solution was that we would change the ISA. We would say, now the way add instructions work is they don't store their value right away, and if you're writing assembly, you need to look at every add instruction and keep that in mind and make sure you write some extra instructions before you use the value to make that work. And another solution was that, the hardware can detect this case and insert NOPs itself. So rather than fetching a new instruction, it's going to have some circuitry to ignore the instruction that it should be fetching and send a NOP until we're ready to actually read the correct values. So questions on these things covered last time? Okay, so we're going to go back to these data hazards, and we're going to have a solution that's better than these, but it's not going to work all the time. Before that, let's do some other topics from before. So, had some complaints, anonymous feedback, and elsewhere, about the speed of the grading the feedback on the submission site, probably mostly for the life homework. I guess I would say, when I've given a very similar assignment in 4414 in the past, I never gave automatic feedback before the deadline. And I didn't think that was a problem because the assignment has this section on how to test your code, and you probably need that anyways because you can't really debug based on the autograder saying something failed usefully. And my assumption is therefore, the assignment would have been fine if there were no automatic feedback whatsoever, but I figured I'd provide it because I had it able to be set up. That's why it was there. There's also someone mentioning, but Gradescope is faster. So this is not the experience of faculty I've talked to, that it's sometimes faster, but sometimes has the same kinds of problems. And note that the test for the life assignment, because they run things a bunch of times to try to be consistent about getting triggering race conditions, are a bit slow. And the big surprise, and probably the reason why it was slower than I was planning for, is that a surprising number of submissions hanged on pretty much every test, and therefore it mattered exactly how long I set the timeouts, which I set because based on if I'm grading, doing like making grades, I want to try to run everything. So that was like kind of a big factor. So questions on auto grader issues? Yes.
I don't know about for this assignment, but I do know for like, I think it was a TLB assignment, if even if you passed like all the test cases that were given like in the writing assignment, if you then like submitted it to ITOS, then it would be like a 40% sometimes.
The question is, so that for some prior assignments, you could pass the tests that were given and get a low score. Yeah, so I would say for the TLB assignment, I was surprised that this happened. And I guess I need to rewind the test for that. I think for this assignment, I've given enough that I wouldn't think that. For the TLB assignment, I think usually when that happened, it was a type of problem that wasn't being thought of when those tests were written that caused it. And that's why it wasn't caught by the given sort of example. Is that our follow-ups, other questions, comments? Okay. And I'd also like to talk a little about the lab. So some things that happened in the lab. So the lab kind of divided this geometric mean problem into a map step and a reduce step. And the intention of this was that there's kind of different strategies you want to use to parallelize each of these parts. The map step is how do I compute the value for each element of our input? And the reduce step is how do I combine those all into one number? The solution I expected, which maybe wasn't clear enough in the write-up, is that you'd have one loop that sort of combines a map strategy and a reduce strategy. Some people make something where you had two separate loops and you had an intermediate array. This works, certainly, but it's always going to be a bit slower because we're storing these intermediate values that we don't really need to store. So there are also cases where people were a little surprised at sort of the performance that happened in the lab. So one question is why? A lot of people were surprised, oh, wait a minute, we did this atomic update strategy. Why was it slow all the time? Why was it so slow? If you think of how that works, the processors need to take turns accessing answer. And the way that works is that we have to like give that answer to one processor at a time, one core at a time. And that means that we have multiple threads, but we're actually only really, really running one at a time. Yeah, there's a few things that they can run in parallel, but a lot of the stuff, they can only go one at a time. And in addition, they need to spend time like requesting, hey, other core, give me this, and so on. And so it ends up being slower in many cases than the serial code. Because you're doing one thing at a time and you have this extra work to coordinate making sure it only happens one at a time. And the task queue strategy had a similar problem. And this problem was that we had this counter to determine what's the next thing to work on. And while it is a fairly simple operation to get that counter, this is still something that needs to be done one at a time. So we were kind of, that the threads had to take turns doing. And it turns out that the work of incrementing that counter was like not much less than the amount of work we would do once we got something to work on. So we had this kind of big loss in that we were spending so much time figuring out what to work on and coordinating with the other threads, meaning that that we couldn't have multiple threads do this at the same time, really. And that kind of often would overwhelm the time we actually spent computing values. And finally, some people who implemented the few-to-many reduction strategy with an array were often surprised to find out that it was often much slower than the other version of the few-to-many reduction strategy. And they look basically the same as far as what they're doing. So what's going on there? And the difference is in the sort of earlier strategy, we had you store the values so you were the local result, not in an array, but in a local variable. And here we're storing it in an array. And if we think of how this array is laid out in memory, well, we have it's going to have the things for the different threads right next to each other. And this has to work with caches. And what's going to happen is we're going to have one cache is going to have a whole block from the array. So it's going to have values for multiple threads. And then we want to update that. And the way that the updates are going to work is that the caches are going to have to take turns with the value to do that update. So we end up with something called false sharing, where even though these are distinct values, because they're in the same cache block, we end up paying the cost of coordinating access to them as if they were one value. We have to take turns with that. And that's what happens internally. And this is probably a reason you would observe this pattern being way slower than you'd expect from the one without an array. And as for how do you fix this? So one way to fix it is just have the array be more spread out, like have it be an array of things that are cache block in size with the value in the middle of that. That would be one solution to this problem. Some questions on things with the lab? Okay, so some notes on upcoming labs and homework. So as I mentioned in that email, I've extended the deadlines for the later homeworks. My hope is you can start the pipelining homework after this lecture. But I wanted to keep the due dates on roughly Wednesdays. Also, if you look at the schedule, I've changed what the lab will be next week and the following week. So I have a lab that I need to finish writing for next week on side channels, which will be our last topic with Spectre and Meltdown, and then a C++ lab. And the way that's going to work is I know some of you did a C++ lab in CS01, and some of you did not. So if you did one in CS01, you're going to do a different C++ lab. If you didn't, you're going to do the CS01 C++ lab. Okay, so let's move on to talking about our data hazard situation. So we ran into this situation where we were reading the wrong value. And we had a solution that we would add nops to make this work. And we could either have nops be added by the compiler or assembly writer or by the hardware with what we called stalling. And this would end up lining up our sort of write of register 9 with our read of register 9, and assuming the register file works by letting us read values as they're being written, this will get us the value. Now, if you're paying close attention to how the single cycle processor works, this is actually not the register file that you were using for that single cycle processor design, because if we think of how what our 9, the first add instruction is doing, it's reading from our 9 and writing to it, and we better not receive the value we're writing at the same time as we're reading, or that would mess things up. So if we didn't modify the register file to let us read things while we're writing them, we'd end up having to spend even an extra cycle to make that work. An extra nop. But this one of these versions, depending on how our register file works, would be our stalling solution. And this is kind of disappointing. So this is disappointing. You know, we're wasting two cycles for, we're spending three cycles, probably longer than the single cycle processor, for what is supposed to be a very common pattern of like computing a value and then doing something else with it, and possibly, you know, lots of cycles, could we do better? And if we look at our diagram here of the scenario, the problem was that, you know, we are reading into our, we think of our fetch, decode, execute. We've read from our register file here. We have 900. And in the execute stage, at the same time as we did that reading, we just computed 1700 for the first add. So we actually have both of these values. We actually have the right value computed already. You know, if the problem is that we just read the wrong value, but the right value, it's there in the processor. It's just not in the right place. But we could get it to the right place. So how would we do that? Well, you know, so on our diagram here, here's our 1700 we just computed. And we just want it to replace that 900 we just read. So we just want to add a wire with the shortcut there. Now, of course, we don't always want to do this. So most instructions, we're going to read the value of the register, and we're going to get the right value. So we're going to need to do something to decide to do this sometimes and not to do it other times. So I believe in CS01 you learned about muxes, maybe? Yeah, so we're going to have a mux to do that. I'm not going to show how we're going to decide what the sort of control input to the mux is, but we're going to have a mux to make this decision, and we're going to figure out which input to use based on our bookkeeping information for these instructions. Like, the big thing we're looking for is this the same register we're reading as what's going to be written? So questions about this idea here? Yes. So the question is, what if I'm using the value in a later cycle? Don't we need to handle that case? And yes, so let's talk about that case. And absolutely, so that is something I didn't handle yet. So in this case, I have a NOP between them, and the value is not going to the memory stage, it's going to the write-back stage, but hasn't made it there. And we can solve that by adding another shortcut. And maybe this would be from the other one here. And ultimately what we're going to do is we're going to add all the shortcuts here. Right, all the shortcuts we can. This is going to be a little more complicated because, for example, in this case, I'm going to actually want not to just get it from... So I might, for example, you know, we have pop, like if we have two outputs from the math stage, I'm going to want to add another shortcut for that. But basically, we're going to enumerate all the places a value could be later in the pipeline and have a shortcut to get that value to replace the value we read in some fashion. And this idea is called forwarding. So we're going to take advantage of the fact that often we've already computed the value, and we're going to use that to send the value where it's needed. And this is going to let us avoid stalling, because, you know, if we already computed the value in time, that's going to be sufficient. We don't need to worry about if the value is written in time. We are going to need to worry that it's computed in time. We'll talk about what we do when it's not in a bit. Okay, so questions? Okay, so So let's do a little exercise here. So let's assume we're doing, like in my example, we're forwarding to the decode stage. So I set my shortcut up to go to the end of the decode stage. We could have done it elsewhere. We'll talk about that maybe later, but we'll do it to the decode stage. What would that look like? And for these, where would we forward for these sets of instructions? Give you a minute to look over. Who'd like some more time? Two people. Okay, so start with the first one, and sub QR8 is blink at Q two things A not forwarded from. Who thinks B forwarded to decode from execute? Okay. And C forwarded to decode from memory. D forwarded to decode from write back. No clue. Okay, so we have a bunch of no clues. So let's think about what's going on with this instruction. So this instruction needs to read from R8 and R10. Right. So the question we're gonna have is, if we don't do forwarding, are we gonna read the right values here? And from what we can tell here, it looks like, you know, that if R8 doesn't have an up-to-date value, like the add queue isn't computing it, right? The add queue is going to have the value of, is going to have the new value of R9, but the value of R8 either comes from an earlier instruction that I'm not showing here, or it's just correct in the register file and we don't need to do anything. So we're not going to forward it there, right? So if the value of R8 is somewhere in our pipeline, so R8 either correct or we should fetch the value from an earlier instruction. From earlier instruction, because addQ hasn't computed that value for us. It might technically have it, maybe, but there's no reason for it to have it anymore after it's computing what it's adding. Okay, how about the second option? So we have an XOR R9 is blank at Q. So who thinks A, not forwarded from? Okay. Who thinks B, forwarded from to the code from execute? Think C, forwarded to the code from memory. Okay. Thinks D, forwarded to the code from write back. Thinks no clue. Okay, so we have a split between no clue and forwarded from memory. So I would get that it's forwarded from memory if we're forwarding to the code. We could possibly forward to some other place, but typically would forward, so if we're forwarding just to the end of the code, that's how we get it. And why is it in the memory stage? You might say, wait a moment, there's a couple objections. So the add queue instruction, it computed it in the execute stage. Why don't we forward it from there? Well, the problem is, if we're forwarding it from the execute stage, that's going to be part of the sub-instruction. The sub-instruction is computing R10. It doesn't really have information to help us with R9. So we can't get it from there. So let's look at our other alternative. So we could get it from here, and we know the value is going to be there because it has to be written back eventually, right? So if we computed it in execute and we haven't written it back, it better be somewhere, and we can grab it from there by adding that shortcut. So I would say C here. And if there's an earlier instruction with a value of R9, that version of R9 is not the one that we want to use. We want to use the most recently written version. And as far as the XOR is concerned, that's going to be the one the add computes. We don't want to have the XOR work on some earlier R9. Okay, so questions? I came up with that solution. Okay. Okay, let's do the next one. So in AND queue, R9 is blank AD queue. So who thinks A, not forwarded from? Okay, some people for that. Thinks B, forwarded to the code from execute of AD queue. Cool. Who thinks C, forwarded to the code from memory? And how about D, forwarded to the code from write back? Okay, so we have a mix between not forwarded and forwarded to the code from write back. So let's talk about what forwarding to the code from write back would look like. So that would mean that we'd be grabbing this value that is about to be written and sending it there. And that's definitely something we could do. So I note that that works for write back. We couldn't forward from the add queue's memory stage or execute stage because that would involve some time travel. So we can't do that. So it has to be, so if we're getting it from add queue, it has to be from the write back stage. Because otherwise, you know, those other stages don't have the add queue instruction anymore. So we could grab this value, but let's think about what's happening here. Let's say I have R8 is 800 and R9 is 900. Then here, we're going to compute R9 becomes 1700, and that would be the value we'd forward. But if we think of how this instruction is going to execute, later on, we're going to compute R9 is going to be 1700 XOR'd with 800. And if we think of sort of tracing through what this assembly does by hand, if I asked you just after we execute the XOR, what's the value of R9, you're going to tell me it's the one app with the XOR equation, not the 1700. So that's the value we better get. So we can, we absolutely have the physical circuitry that we could take the value from the write-back stage to here, but we don't want to do that because that's the wrong value. If we do that, we're going to be reading this old value, which, you know, is the same kind of problem we started out with. We just got a different version of it. We're still reading the wrong version, an old, outdated value. And so I would say the right answer is that if we're forwarding the value, it's not coming from AddKey. Some questions? My reasoning for that? Okay, so let's look at the final case. In NQ, R9 is blank XOR. So he thinks A, it's not forwarded from XOR. Okay, B, forwarded from to the code from execute of XOR. Okay, forwarded to the code from memory of XOR. And forwarded to the code from write back of XOR. Okay, so mostly we have B, which is what I get. So let's find a new color. So we have B, and the thing we're actually going to do is this. That XOR is going to just have computed the value. We'll have that substitute for the value we read. And that's, in fact, what we want to do. So that's the most up-to-date version of R9. So it's the right one. And so that's something we're going to need. And we have to forward it from where the value is in the XOR instruction right now when we're doing it. So if we're sending it to decode, it has to come from the execute stage because that's the only place in the processor where values from the XOR instruction are going to be. Some questions? My reasoning here. Yes? Question, why is the value outdated when we take it from the write-back? So if we think of our assembly code here, right, in the assembly code, this is the first instruction and this is the third one. And the value we want is going to be from the later instruction. Now, as for why is the earlier instruction further in the pipeline, well, that's because things get further in the pipeline by starting earlier. So remember, the way our pipeline works is that we start in fetch and you go to write back. So if you're write back first, that means you must be an older instruction. And the reason why this is okay as far as the overall order is because this means that the later instructions will make it to write back later, and the final one that makes it to write back is the value we're going to end up with. So another way of thinking about it is the instruction that's in execute is better candidate than the one in write back because it's the one that's going to be written last. We know the one in write back is going to be written right now, so the one in execute is going to be written later. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Are there some processors that if they detect like register 9 is in write back and in execute, they just won't write it back at the top? Or that not really say
the question, are there some processors which would detect this situation and avoid writing back register 9 for the first case? I don't know. As for would that save resources, I suspect it wouldn't save resources in the general case. And probably the biggest concern I'd have with thinking that saves resources is, let's say this subtract instruction was like a move from memory. It could segfault. And if it's seg faults, we better have the value of R9 stored in the register. And so probably because of issues like that, it's not worth trying to figure out when you can save on writing it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
thank you. OK, other questions? Yeah. So the question is, how do we make the selection circuitry for the MUX? So we're going to gloss over the details of that. But basically, we're going to have to do something where we are comparing, if we think of this AND instruction here, we're going to compare this 9 with this 9 and this 10 and this 9 to make that decision. Does that answer your question? So basically, we're going to be comparing all the register numbers, and that's how we're going to arrive at which signal we use. And we might also need other information, like what the instruction is. So we might also need to know that it's NXOR and factor that into our logic. So this logic for figuring out when to forward can get complicated, which is why we're not going into... We're going to go into how to do it manually, but we're not going to go into how do you write that logic correctly. Other questions? Okay. So, as you can see, like, we have lots of cases where we can have values be forwarded. So, as an example, like, here's some little snippet of assembly. Let's think about what forwarding happens. And to think about that, sort of my systematic way would be, you know, I'd first look at, you know, are we reading a value that might come from an earlier value? So the first thing I notice is that, oh, R9 in the second instruction is written by the first one. So that's what I'll call a dependency. And, you know, we see that R9 isn't written in time for us to read it, so I'm going to do forwarding to make that happen. Then I see that R9 is also read down here. So I'm going to have either some forwarding or my register file is going to need to work such that I can write things while I read them to make that happen. And then I have R11 here is written by the subtract instruction, read by the move instruction. So that's going to be a case where I'm going to have another piece of forwarding there, because if I look at the subtract instruction, it's writing the value over here. Over here, and the move instruction is trying to read it here. That's not in time. We need to fix that somehow, and forwarding happens to work. And the same thing is true for the next instruction, this move that uses R11. So remember, that's using it to compute an address. We better have the value to compute the address. So we're going to forward that too. Then I have this move from here. So normally this would be written in writeback, but we need it a cycle earlier than that. So I'm going to forward that to the XOR. And I can look at my next instruction here. I look at this case here. So I have R9 written by the add instruction. There's not R9's used by earlier instructions, but it's not modified. And then I have it read by this XOR. Do I need to forward for this case? Well, we look at where does the XOR read the value. It reads it here in cycle 5. And it's already written by then. We don't need to do anything. So even though we're using a value, we've waited long enough that there's no hazard. Yeah?
So is the reason that arrows are like pointing to the end of the decode section is because it still computes it, but it just replaces it at the end?
Question, is the reason the arrows are pointing to the end of the code section because it still computes it, but it just replaces it at the end? Yes, so I'm assuming we use this style of circuitry to implement it. There are other ways we could implement it. So for example, I could send it to the beginning of the execute stage, in which case a bunch of things would be different. But I'm choosing to do this to the end of the decode stage, sort of as a normal case. Does that answer your question? There. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So you can, yes.
Can you go over again what the two arrows are in cycle 4?
Question, can I go over what the two arrows are in cycle 4? Sure. So in cycle 4, we found out that this move queue instruction that writes to 8 parentheses R11, it needs the value of R11 to know how to compute that address, and that's computed by the subqueue. So we're going to need to forward from the subqueue, I guess I'll highlight this in red here, to there to make that work. We need to forward somewhere to the subqueue instruction. And also, it needs the value of R9 to know what to store in that memory location. And either we need a register file to handle letting us read a value while it's being written, or we need to do some forwarding to handle that scenario. Meaning we need to have that shortcut. Does that answer your question? Okay, so this is sort of an example of all the types of forwarding you might do. And one case that comes up is that sometimes we have multiple options, right? So our basic logic for forwarding is going to be, like, is the register that's being computed the one I'm trying to read? If so, let's take that value, but we have to be careful. One way we have to be careful is that in this case, the last add better get the value from the second add, not the first one, or else you'd be rather disappointed that the processor decided just not to add R11. Not acceptable to do. So even though, yes, we could fetch the value of R8 earlier, it's not going to be nice. We're not going to be happy. We also have cases where we'll forward both of the operands to a two-operand instruction. That's perfectly fine to do. And that also means that in the diagram I showed here, I was incomplete in that, here we actually have, we have like two values being read from the register, and we're going to have a mux for both of them, which is, again, another reason why we're not having you implement sort of a simulator for this. But, we're going to have to handle forwarding for potentially all the operands to an instruction. And often we'll end up forwarding both of them, especially in code that has dependencies like this, where we need to have the prior instructions run to run the next ones. Yes? Well, I always want to grab the most recently used value. We always want to grab the most recently computed value. So I'm being careful to say computed and not used because, for example, we're not going to grab R10 here regardless if we used it because, it's not computing the value of R10.
Like,
so the question, to decide where to get R8, do we want the most recent access to R8? We want the most recent modification, computing of a new value for R8. So for example, if we had add R10, R8, and then we had add R8, R12, we would still want to grab the R8 from the add instruction that's actually computing it, because we wouldn't know that the other instruction would actually keep the value of R8 around after it's done using it. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. How does this work if you use memory addresses rather than registers? So a convenient feature of our pipeline is that all the data cache accesses happen in the memory stage, which means that they happen one after another after another. So as far as, if you're worried about what if I write a value to memory and then read it, we don't have that problem because all the reading and writing happens sort of in order. If your question is, what about registers I use to compute memory addresses, we still have to forward those, just like the operands to add, like we saw here with R11, for example. We have to forward that because, we need to get that register value, but it's going to work the same way as operands to arithmetic instructions. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Other questions? So I guess talking about memory, something I should probably mention as an aside is that if we're writing to memory here, we think of how this write to memory here works. I write to memory here, which means that if I were to do something like overwrite the machine code for this XOR instruction, we're not going to notice yet. We're going to fetch the wrong thing. And most pipeline processors' answer to that problem is don't do that. Other questions? Okay. So, this forwarding seems to solve our data hazards, but there's a case that doesn't get handled. And that's this case. So here I have a move from memory into a register, and then I use that register to do some arithmetic. And the problem is, so if we were doing forwarding the way we saw before, we'd like to forward from execute to the end of the code. That doesn't really work, because the way this and move instruction works is that we're going to read the value from the data cache in the memory stage. We can't get it in the execute stage. It's not there. So that doesn't work. And we could say, well, we can get it in the memory stage, but then it's too late. Right? We could send it to the memory stage, but if I gave you the shortcut for that, if I just said, okay, we're going to let you get this value over to here, you'd be pretty unhappy about that. It doesn't actually help you use it to subtract anything. So what we're going to end up doing instead is, is combining stalling with forwarding. So in this case, I'm doing the stalling by I'm going to insert a NOP in our pipeline. So rather than sending the subtract instruction through the pipeline, we're going to have a NOP run later on. And we're going to have the fetch stage sort of do nothing. And here I'm showing it happen that we repeat the decode stage. We could also repeat the fetch stage. I'm just showing us repeating the decode stage because often what will happen is we'll fetch the instruction, we'll try to read its registers, and we'll detect as part of that process, oh, wait a moment, these values aren't ready. So we'll hold the instruction back in its decode stage. We could also represent this as doing a stall by repeating the fetch stage the same way. So we'll stall, but we won't stall enough to wait for the value to be written. We'll just wait for it to be available to be forwarded, which in this case means after the memory, at the end of the memory stage, the value is available. We can't get it earlier. So questions here? Yeah. So question is about both subqueues. Yeah, so the first subqueue is representing that we kind of rewrote this pipeline diagram as the same instruction.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what exactly is the hazard
here? What exactly is the problem here? So we want to get the value of RBX that this move instruction computes. But the earliest we can get it is near the end of cycle 3, because it comes from memory. So we have to wait for the memory stage to be pretty much done before we have that value. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we have this problem here. So this is going to be our solution to the cases where forwarding isn't quite enough, that we can add a bit of stalling, but it's not going to be nearly as bad as our original stalling, where I had to insert a whole bunch of NOPs. Here, I'm basically only inserting one by delaying my subtract instruction by one cycle, meaning that during that one cycle, I'm going to have the rest have some stages of our pipeline do nothing. And I have the wrong version of this slide. So we'll ignore things about textbooks because I copied this from another, from 3330. But this is another type of forwarding we can do. And it's a special case. So you might say, wait a moment, if I have here, oh, I really didn't edit this slide. So if I just have move instructions, ignore the prefix on the move. So if I'm moving a value into a register and then back into memory, this is actually a case where we don't need to stall. And this is because I showed us forwarding to the end of the decode stage, but we don't actually need to do that. We can forward to later. So in this example, I've decided I'm going to forward from the end of memory to the end of execute. And that's going to make this work. That's how I'm going to get the value of RBX between these two instructions without stalling. And that's fine because I don't need to use RBX until the memory stage and the other instruction. So it's going to be ready in time. So you might say, if I can forward to the execute stage, why didn't I do that in this case instead of stalling? Why did I have the instruction take an extra cycle and therefore delay absolutely everything else? And well, the answer is, well, if I was forwarding to the execute stage in that case, I'd be asking you to do this. And that's not acceptable. And the reason why it's not acceptable is because if I think of what needs to happen in a clock cycle, now what needs to happen in a clock cycle is I need to go through the data cache and then go through this my math logic. And if that needs to happen in a clock cycle, why did I bother putting these in separate stages? Right, I basically am requiring me to combine the two stages. So that's why when I've done forwarding, I've always shown us going explicitly from the end of a stage to the end of a stage, rather than taking any shortcuts, any sort of clever things like this where we go to a different part of the stage. That's because if we do that, we kind of defeat the purpose of pipelining, right? The idea of pipelining is I only needed to have enough time in my clock cycle to do one of these things, but now I need to do both. So questions about our forwarding and stalling case. Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So we have our pipeline. So I want to ask, where do we have dependencies? Okay, so I should talk about this dependencies and hazards. So hazards are those cases where we get the wrong value. And we're going to have a more generic term of dependencies. This will come up later when we talk about sort of more advanced ways of running instructions in parallel. But a hazard is cases where it won't work before we resolve them. Let's do this exercise and figure out where do we have dependencies. So these are cases where the two instructions depend on each other. And those are the things we should watch for. Is there a hazard here? Do I need to do something like forwarding to resolve that situation? And I find it helpful for these sorts of problems to start to write a pipeline diagram. So I can see, you know, how these instructions are going to execute in time relative to each other. Okay, who would like some more time? Oh. Okay, so I'll start by, I've highlighted what I think are the dependencies. That's like what we want to look at first to figure out, you know, these are the cases where the instructions need values from another. So I can look at the add instruction, it writes to RBX, and I say, do any of these following instructions use that? Yes, the last add, the first add value is used by the last one. So that's a dependency. Then I want to answer, is this going to be a hazard? So I look at, okay, when does this actually get written? And I find out, well, it gets written here, it gets read here. This is not, there's no actual hazard here that it's going to work perfectly even if we did no forwarding. Because we're writing the value into the register file with before it actually gets read by that later instruction. So then I can look at the subtract instruction. It's writing to RCX. And I see if any other instructions are using that. And I look at my next instruction. It uses RCX, but it's not a dependency. And why? Well, the move instruction doesn't care what RCX used to be. So it doesn't actually care about that subtract. There's no dependency there. And it seems like it probably someone didn't intend to write this assembly. So there's no dependency there. I don't need to worry about hazards. We don't. The move instruction doesn't care about whether it's reading an out-of-date version of RCX. We don't need to read it. So we're not going to bother forwarding it. Then I have the move instruction's use of RCX. This value of RCX is used by this add instruction here. Note that this is the RCX that this add instruction uses, not the one the subtract makes, because it's not, because we go instruction by instruction. And that's the one that, the most recent one is the one that matters. And as for this as a hazard, well, normally it would be written in its write-back stage, which is during that add instruction's memory stage. So we have a problem. It's too late. So we're going to need to deal with that by actually forwarding the value. It shouldn't be a problem. It's a constant. We should have it available to forward. Then I have this add instruction here that writes to R10, which is used by the next one. And we find out again that it would write it here and want to be read here. So that's not going to work. So we're going to need forwarding to resolve that problem. We're going to send it from the execute stage of the add from RCX to the execute state to the decode stage of the add of RBX. Some questions? Yes. So when do we stall instead of forwarding? We would stall instead of forwarding if the value wasn't available in time. So it turns out with this state pipeline design, the only case where that happens is when we have something like this, we have a memory access, so the value is not available to the memory stage, and we need it in the next decode stage. But if it's a computed in the if it's available in the execute stage, that's soon enough for us to forward it. So, you know, other than when we're accessing memory, it doesn't come up. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. In the last add queue, we don't forward it.
RBX.
We don't forward RBX because it's already written? Yes. And in fact, we can't, even if we wanted to forward it, we can't do it because, you know, it's not, it's too late. By the time we figure out what registers to read, it's already, the instruction we read them from is already out of the pipeline. Other questions? So let's do, so mention that I'm showing us with the five-stage pipeline, which is kind of, as I mentioned, sort of what many early processor designs of this sort did, but we could have different pipeline stages. Like I could have a four-stage pipeline, and in that case, we'd have something that previously was a hazard become not a hazard because of our shorter pipeline. And if we have a longer pipeline, we'll have more hazards. So as an example, let's go through this case here, where let's say instead of having one execute stage, I have two. So my ads, I assume I'm taking 2 cycles to do them instead of 1. And computations. So I'll start us off in the interest of time. The first thing I'm going to look at is this second instruction needs to read a value from the first one. And that value is going to be computed over here. So if we do the natural thing and say, OK, we're going to do fetch, decode, execute 1, execute 2, well, it's not available in time for us to start execute 1 with that value. So what am I going to do about that? I'm going to do some stalling. So I'll represent stalling by us keeping the instruction in the decode stage. We could also represent it by repeating the fetch stage. Either is equivalent. And that's what we'll have to do. And then we'll be able to forward the value in time for execute one. So questions on my reasoning there? So exercises to do the rest of these. So someone get me what should happen in the next line. Yeah.
You would forward R9 from the left end of E2 for instruction 1 to instruction 3.
OK, so your idea is that we're going to start the instruction here, and we're going to forward R9 here. So I like this idea, but there's a problem, which is that we're having 2 things in decode at the same time. We can't do that. So because we're keeping the add instruction back in decode, this instruction, the next instruction, is not going to be able to move on in the pipeline. It's going to be stuck. So it's as if like I just kept something in the dryer for an extra cycle. That means my washer doesn't get to do anything. So we're going to keep it back. So we're not going to be able to do the decode stage of this instruction until cycle 4, because that's the earliest time our decode stage is free. And that's the point at which we'll be able to forward the value. So we will end up forwarding R9. We're going to forward it from the memory stage. So questions on how I figured that out so that we can't advance this instruction to decode yet until the decode stage is free and the forwarding we do. Okay. So then we compute R9 in this instruction, and it's needed in the next instruction. And so that instruction is going to start its fetch, going to do its decode, and what's going to happen? No volunteers. Yeah?
You have to stall again.
You have to stall again? So, okay. So we're going to stall. Okay. And then what?
And then you're going to
read. And then we're going to forward read the value from the previous instruction, is what you're saying? Okay. Yeah. So then we could forward the value here. So I agree that's probably, that's the simplest solution. So remember, we had this trick that we didn't have to forward to the code stage if we didn't need the value there. And this instruction, when does it use the value of R9? Well, it doesn't use the value of R9 until the memory stage. So we can actually avoid stalling and just forward the value later. That's OK, because we don't have a problem. Now, there is something else we need to forward for this instruction, though. So for this instruction, we have R9. We also need RBX, which is going to come from instruction 2. So we're going to take RBX from instruction 2. Where does that come from? Well, instruction 2 didn't write it yet. So we need to also forward that, and we'll probably forward it to the end of decode. It's probably easiest. And then we have this move instruction that runs independently. And I have this worked out here as far as what happens. So way of working it out is I just write out all the instructions, figure out, oh, wait a moment, R9 isn't available. So I just shift everything over for the stalling. That's what stalling is going to do. It's going to delay all the later instructions. And then I figure out, OK, I can forward R9 from the memory stage there. And for this instruction, I can, you know, I have multiple options to forward R9. As long as it gets there before memory, it's fine for R9. But for RBX, we just get it the normal way. So questions? How I figured that out. Okay, so that's all about forwarding. And our topic for next time, we're going to start by talking about resolving a different type of hazard. So this is forwarding we're dealing with. How do I get the value I need to compute the things the instructions are computing or access memory and so on? There's one other type of hazard we haven't dealt with, which is what we'll call control hazards. So here, I'm doing a comparison and then a jump of equals. And if we think of our pipeline, the comparison's done in the execute stage. So I have this problem that I want to figure out where to jump to, and I haven't figured out that the result of the comparison was less than early enough. So how are we going to deal with this? And when I started by talking about data hazards, I introduced our simple solutions of sort of adding knobs or stalling. So stalling, that works for this. Yeah, we can't do forwarding to solve this problem, but we can certainly do stalling. And so we'll just have our compare set the flags that our conditional jump instructions is using. Then in the next cycle, our jump can use those flags to figure out, does it go to the label or not? Find out it does not. I should say compute if the jump goes to the label. And then finally, after that, we can finally fetch the correct place. So that would be one solution. So questions on this stalling idea here. So yeah, basically we just delay the future instructions until we figure out where the jump goes. So that's one thing we can do. But there's a better solution. And that's that we can guess. We can just guess that it won't go to the label, or it will, and just start fetching instructions based on our guess. And you might say, OK, so I agree that this works great if we're right, right? If we're right, we just keep going. Sounds great. Problem is, what if we're wrong? Haven't we just set R11 to something? Well, the answer is going to be no. Because what we can do when we guess wrong is we can undo those instructions that we started fetching, which is known as squashing them. So we'll just get rid of them from the pipeline. And as long as we do that before they change any registers or memory, that's fine. And so we'll pick up talking more about this idea called, which is called branch prediction, next time.